speak in that order. As editor of Negro Digest, Hoyt Fuller has been at the very center of the black literary movement in recent years. Harold Cruz is now acting director of the Black Studies Program at the University of Michigan, the author of The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual and Rebellion or Revolution. He was for many, many years a resident of Harlem and at the center of cultural and political activity in that community. Mr. Fuller will speak first, followed by Mr. Cruz, after which there may be some dialogue between the two, and then questions from the floor will be invited. Mr. Hoyt Fuller.
Thank you, that's nice. Hope you'll applaud when I'm finished. The overall theme for the weekend of talks, I understand, is black intellectuals and white response. And the title of my little talk is The New Black Literature, Affirmation and Rejection. I suppose, as a consequence of my experience this afternoon, when presumably someone in the audience thought that some of my statements were anti-Semitic, that I ought to say at the outset that nothing that I'm going to say is intended to be anti-anything except anti those human beings who are inhuman. There is a revolution in black literature in America. It is nationalist in direction, and it is pro-black. That means, in effect, that it is deliberately moving outside the sphere of traditional Western forms, limitations, and presumptions. It is seeking new forms, new limits, new shapes, and much of it now, admittedly, is crude, reflecting the uncertainty, the searching quality of its movement. But though troubled and seeking, it is very, very vital. The creators of the new black literature are deeply concerned with image and myth. They are about the business of destroying those myths and images which have crippled and degraded black people, and the institution of new myths and images which will liberate them. Throughout the talk, I'll quote some of the young black writers. This one, Larry Neal, for instance, who's a resident of New York City and who is one of the finest of the developing young critics. He's also a very fine poet. And speaking about the new literature, he says, "It is almost axiomatic that most of what the West considers important endangers the more humane world we, black people, young black people, feel ours to be. Most contemporary black writing of the last few years, the literature of the young, has been aimed at the destruction of the double consciousness." He has reference here to the double consciousness that W.B. Du Bois talked about in Souls of Black Folk, back in the end of the 19th century, in which he described black people as being two souls, two thoughts, two unreconciled strivings, two warring ideals in one black body whose dogged strength alone keeps it from being torn asunder. continuing Mr. Neal's quote, it has been aimed at consolidating the new literature, the African-American personality, and it has not been essentially a literature of protest. It is a literature primarily directed at the consciences of the people, of black people, and in that sense, it is a literature that is somewhat more mature than that which preceded it. The white world, the West, is seen now as a dying creature, totally bereft of spirituality. This being the case, the only hope is some kind of psychic withdrawal from its values and assumptions. In the article, The Black Writer and His Roles, published in the January 1969 issue of Negro Digest, another of the fine developing young critics, Carolyn Gerald, explains why image is so central to a man's self-definition. Because, she says, all images, and especially created images, represent a certain way of focusing on the world outside. And therefore, they represent a certain point of view. Now, if we hold a certain point of view, we have automatically emphasized some aspects of reality, blocked out others, and glossed over the rest. And the image which we project or which we perceive is not objective reality, but our own, or someone else's, reshaping of reality. If it is someone else's reshaping of reality which we perceive, then we are within the other person's sphere of influence and can be led to believe whatever he wishes us to believe. That a rose bush is pleasant because it has a fragrant smell, or that it is unpleasant because it has thorns. If these two images of the rose bush are combined into a metaphor, we have created images which lead us to make an association between the reality of the rose bush and another level of reality, and we can be influenced, for instance, on a moral level. Pleasant smelling roses have unpleasant thorns. Therefore, beware the sweet fragrance of pleasure, for underneath it lie hidden the thorns of destruction. In this way, the association made in the mind of the hearer or reader is controlled. By controlling our associations, the image maker can, and usually does, shape our view of reality. Because the images the words conjure up, when they are put together artistically, provoke an immediate emotional response in us, and dim out of our consciousness all the untold other points of view at our disposal. The trouble with black literature in the United States is, and always has been, the white literary establishment. If that idea seems shocking at first, then consider it for a moment. Literature, after all, is not separate from life, although many white critics seem to want to separate black literature from the realities of black life. The literature of any people grows organically out of the experiences of that people, informed by imagination and wit, the gift, in short, of artistry. Black literature in America is, and always has been, handicapped by literary colonialism. The rules of literature and the criteria for literary achievement are established by white critics and scholars who share a general experience and perspective. These rules and criteria are then imposed on the works of black writers who have qualitatively different experiences and who approach these experiences from an essentially different angle of vision. If theoretically the values underlying both white and black experiences are the same, then the area between the white and black interpretation of those values is vast, almost beyond bridging. Consider, America is a racist society. That is, opportunities and rewards are apportioned, for the most part, according to race and color. The preferred and the privileged are white, the rejected and the degraded are non-white. The whites, who are in the majority and who hold the power, proceed under the very natural assumption that the nation's vaunted principles, creeds, and institutions are both valid and operative. The non-whites understand that much of the so-called good life for white Americans is bought at the price of their continued subjugation. In Chicago, for example, Hundreds of thousands of ordinary white people have access to high-paying jobs because they do not have to compete with the million black people who live in that city. Those million black people know that they are being debased and cheated. And that knowledge shapes their attitude toward both the people who cheat and debase them and toward the society which condones it. The white boy who grows up as a writer might fashion prose or poetry which strikes at the fabric of the social structure which ensures injustice against his non-white fellow citizens. But he does not, at the same time, remove himself from his position in that society, which brings him the benefits of that very injustice. His, then, is a moral stance. And though he may be serious enough to take certain real risk to his person or to his position in defense of it, he cannot reject the privileged status which is the gift of his whiteness. On the other hand, the black boy who grows up to be a writer is fighting for his life, both literally and literarily. And while he certainly feels morality is on his side in the struggle, his stance can never be merely moral. Choice in that matter is a luxury forever denied him. The white boy can approach the great question of racism with a certain detachment. His conscience is under siege, not his very being. He could, at some conceivable point, reverse his attitude toward the whole question of racism and injustice without serious consequence to his image of his own humanity. But the black boy who manages to divest himself of his outrage must, in the process, diminish his own humanity, to say nothing of his manhood. His detachment must be achieved at considerable cost to his sense of self. Now, conscious and unconscious racism is everywhere, infecting all the vital areas of national life. But the revolutionary black writer, like the new breed of militant activists, has decided that white racism will no longer exercise its insidious control over his work. If the tag of racist is one the white critic will hang on him in dismissing him, then he is more than willing to bear that. He is not going to separate literature from life. But now, just how widespread is white racism in literature? In a review of Gwendolyn Brooks's selected poems in the old New York Herald Tribune Book Week, this is back in October 1963, poet Lewis Simpson began by writing that the Chicago Poets' Book of Poems, quote, contains some lively pictures of Negro life, unquote, which was an ambiguous enough opener, which was not necessarily a literary put-down of Miss Brooks's work. But Mrs. Simpson's next sentence dispelled all ambiguity. This is what he said. I am not sure it is possible for a Negro to write well without making us aware he is a Negro. On the other hand, if being a Negro is the only subject, the writing is not important. All the history of American race relations is contained in that appraisal. It is civilized, urbane, gentle, and elegant, and it is arrogant, condescending, presumptuous, and racist. To most white readers, no doubt, Mr. Simpson's words, if not his assessment, seemed eminently sensible. There were, for instance, no letters of protest to Book Week about that assessment of Miss Brooks's work. But it is all but impossible to imagine a black reader not reacting to his words with unalloyed fury. Now, both black and white readers are likely to go to the core of Mr. Simpson's statement, which is, if being a Negro is the only subject, the writing is not important. The white reader will, in all probability, find that clear and acceptable enough. Indeed, he is used to hearing it. Certainly, the argument might proceed. To be important, writing must have universal values. Universal implications. It cannot deal exclusively with Negro problems. The plain but unstated assumption being that there are no universal values and no universal implications in black life. Now, Mr. Simpson is a greatly respected American poet, a winner of the Pulitzer Prize for poetry, as is Miss Brooks. And it would be considered the depth of irresponsibility to just label him a racist. He's probably the gentlest and most compassionate of men. Miss Brooks met Mr. Simpson a few weeks after this review appeared. She met him out at the University of California. And of course, she didn't mention the review to him, but she came back and she said that she'd never met anybody who was more genteel and polite. The essential point here is not the presence of overt hostility. It is the absence of clarity of vision. The glass through which black life is viewed by white Americans is, inescapably, it is a matter of degree, befogged by the hot breath of history. True objectivity, where race is concerned, is as rare as a necklace of hope diamonds. Black literature, as written literatures go, is not very old. Prior to the Civil War, a few novels by black writers were published, and I'm going into a bit of literary history here for the benefit of some of the younger people who, unfortunately, seem sometimes not to have gone back beyond 1960 when the revolution started. A few novels by black writers were published, and so were some poems, the best known of which were the works of Phyllis Wheatley, the celebrated house slave. There were some newspapers published by blacks, including one in New Orleans, which was bilingual and published in both French and English, a daily newspaper, and a number of journals. The writings of Frederick Douglass were rather well known, and his autobiography remains a work of distinction. There were some notable histories, slave narratives, and a few novels. However, it was not until the advent of Paul Ernst Dunbar and Charles Chestnut toward the end of the 19th century that works which qualified as literature by those whose prerogative it is to make such judgments were published. Both men produced several novels, and Dunbar, of course, gained considerable eminence for his poetry, especially for that written in dialect. In the years between 1900 and the early 20s, a number of black novelists and poets were published, with even the great W.B. Du Bois trying out his hand at fiction. Now, Robert A. Bone, the white professor whose book, The Negro Novel in America, has long been considered the definitive work on the subject, wrote that, quote, "Most Negro novelists will produce only one or two novels in any case." And he backed up that declaration with the observation that of 62 novelists writing between 1853 and 1952, 40, or two-thirds of them, have published only one novel. 11 more have published only two novels, and only 11 have published more than two. Now, this information is offered in Mr. Bone's book with no qualifications. And it is rather typical of the critical approach to black writers and writing, which has proven so damaging over the years. Now, apart from the fact that Mr. Bone offered no comparable statistics of the productivity of most white writers, which might have made his statistics on black productivity irrelevant in any case, the implications of his statements are rather insidious. The suggestion is that some defect in the nature, a character, or industry of black writers prevented them from producing more novels. But the truth is that Mr. Bone has simply compiled his statistics without reference to his own data on the socioeconomic conditions under which black people lived between 1853 and 1952. And those conditions, of course, explain everything. To begin with, the 100-year period covered by Mr. Bone's statistics included the Civil War, Reconstruction, the post-Reconstruction era, during which the South virtually stripped black people of all their constitutional rights, the rise of the Ku Klux Klan, the two great migrations of blacks from the rural South to the urban North, the two world wars, and the Depression. During much of this time, middle-class black communities of some size and importance existed only in a few centers, like Atlanta, Georgia, and Washington, D.C. And the audience for books by black authors was small indeed. Despite those concessions which black writers were forced to make in order to see their works in print, they did not attempt to totally exclude from their work the natural sentiments of black people. The poems and novels of black writers reflected the anguish and the bitterness black people felt within a society which would not leave them free to pursue their own lives. The poems and stories also expressed the hope, tenaciously held, that the nation will live up to its laws, which promised equality of opportunity and treatment to all its citizens. And black literature faithfully recorded the experiences of black people who, no matter how accomplished or distinguished, inevitably found themselves at some point or time frustrated by a racial wall which no powers on earth could obliterate. This refusal of black writers to withhold from their works the harsh reality of race, or their failure to soften its impact by glossing it over, did not serve to endear black writing to the critics. In his highly praised little book, Black on White, A Critical Survey of Writing by American Negroes, David Littlejohn used a great deal of space describing the, quote, pain a white reader is likely to feel upon reading black writing. A white reader, I'm quoting Mr. Littlejohn, a white reader is saddened, then burdened, then numbed by the deadly sameness, the bleak wooden round of ugly emotions and ugly situations, the same small frustrated dreams, the same issues and charges and formulas and events repeated over and over in book after book. He reluctantly admits that the white reader and critic is likely to try to evade the pain of black writing by a number of what he calls escapes. And he lists the following as the most sophisticated of the many escapes. The escape of literary judgment. It's poorly done, the critic will say of the poem or the novel or the short story. Amen, end of problem. One tends to fall back on this last evasion, which quite frequently in the case of the more militant Negro literature, it isn't literature. Propaganda with a plot, or in rhyme or in acts, unconvincing, lifeless, unearned, unfelt, uncrafted. Such criticisms are often only illicit self-defenses against pain, Mr. Littlejohn continues. A reader slips on the rubber gloves of criticism to avoid the sting. But has he, the white reader, no right to make literary judgments in wartime, as it were? Many of these critiques, interior or in print, are of the nature of moral evasions, but many of the wounds being evaded are illicit and unfair. It is unfair of the black writer to make the white reader feel this pain. Is the white reader simply to sit there turning pages and squirming, Mr. Littlejohn asks. Well, what the white critic has done, incidentally, Mr. Littlejohn, out at the University of California at Berkeley, on the faculty there, opposed the institution of courses in black literature. What the white critic has done, providing a convenient evasion for the white reader, is to characterize his protest all writing by black authors which deals honestly and passionately with the black experience. As protest, this literature can be dismissed, placed in a special category somewhere on the far periphery of art. And in not confronting the literature as art, it is then somehow possible to take less seriously what it says and what it means. Black literature accuses, and its charges must be denied. Jean-Paul Sartre, the French philosopher novelist, has posed in general terms the question black literature asks white America. How can our century possess a conscience and yet live with the monstrous crimes it commits? Countless black writers have foundered and failed in an effort to please the critics and, of course, the publishers by shielding their work from the abrasiveness which the critics describe as protest. The critics for a long while advised black writers to choose universal subjects, to write about characters and situations with whom readers, meaning white readers, could identify. And because black writers have egos as large as any others, and because they want to eat, some of the best of them did the critics' bidding. Anne Petrie, Zora Neale Hurston, William Attaway, and even Richard Wright wrote books in the 40s and 50s which had no black characters. And Willard Motley and Frank Yerby built literary careers writing about whites. This was in the wake of World War II, when many blacks, having helped to win the struggle against fascistic tyranny in Europe, fascistic quote unquote, truly believed that a new era of brotherhood and unity had been ushered in at home. The philosophy abroad in the land taught that all men were really the same under the skin, and black people really wanted to believe it. Even James Baldwin, one of the best writers of this generation, bought the assimilationist philosophy and proceeded to launch a brilliant literary attack against the works of Richard Wright in particular and all protest literature in general. He lived to regret it. He soon discovered, as he found fame, that the same critics who had lavished praise on him for his assault on protest literature now lumped his own works under that label. Mr. Baldwin doesn't talk about protest anymore. It was in the early 20s, at the beginning of the so-called Harlem Renaissance, that black writers first made that declaration of independence from both the dictatorial literary establishment and the latent urge to whiteness. The credo was stated by young Langston Hughes, the best known writer of that movement. And this is what he said. To my mind, it is the duty of the younger Negro artist to change through the force of his art that old whispering, I want to be white, hidden in the aspirations of his people, to, why should I want to be white? I am a Negro and beautiful. So I am ashamed for the black poet who says, I want to be a poet, not a Negro poet, as though his own racial world were not as interesting as any other world. I am ashamed, too, for the colored artist who runs from the painting of Negro faces to the painting of sunsets, after the manner of academicians, because he fears the strange unwhiteness of his own features. An artist must be free to do what he does, certainly, but he also must never be afraid to do what he might choose. We younger Negro artists who create now intend to express our individual dark-skinned selves without fear or shame. If white people are pleased, we are glad. If they are not, it doesn't matter either. We build our temples for tomorrow, strong as we know how, and we stand on the top of the mountain, free within ourselves. Those were rather brave words for a black writer, a black artist of any kind, back in 1923. Now, Langston Hughes kept to that creed all of his life, although he watched writers younger than himself abandon or reject it. And it must have been gratifying to him in the final years of his life, Langston Hughes died in 1967, when he saw a new crop of black artists emerging upon the scene who, though ignorant of the credo that he had advanced in 1923, began to speak out in words very similar to his own. The young writers of the Black Revolution, at last, are able to do what the militant young writers of Langston Hughes' generation merely dreamed of doing. To begin with, they have an audience. Books by black writers sell very well in the growing number of black-owned bookshops in cities across the nation, and a number of lively black journals publish the poems and stories they produce. Black theater companies are organized in the ghettos to produce the plays, and writers' conferences are held periodically so that the writers can come together and exchange ideas and reinforce one another in the drive toward literary independence. Where the writers of another generation were persuaded to seek universal subjects and themes, the new black writers are deliberately delving into their own folk culture and traditions, exploring their own history, and creating their own myths. The new poetry is a poetry of exhortation and celebration. And the new prose is a prose of affirmation. The new literature is characterized by a spirit of rejection, rejection of values which have proven useless or destructive or debasing. But there is no protest as protest in it. Here's a poem of rejection by a Chicago poet, Zach Gilbert, he's called, and it's sort of a tongue-in-cheek poem. It's called A Poet Apologizes to His Critics. Let others cry aloud against these things. They tell me this is not the purpose of the poet. Let others cry aloud against these things, but not the poet. He is a fragile singer of more subtle things, like webs of morning fog or evening mist, or petty feet of spring tiptoeing in. Not this loud cry against a broader canvas. It's crude, they say, to sing of Birmingham. Oh, let them march, but do not sing of them. Let pamphleteers shout of Little Rock, Old Miss. But gentle poet, don't soil the pureness of your quieter art with this. Forgive me, critics, if I should cry aloud. Sing out with gusto. Join the artless crowd. And the new poetry is a celebration of blackness and the spirit of Pan-Africanism, as in the works of Willie Kosetsile, the brilliant young South African writer. Mr. Kosetsile wrote what he considers his credo as a poet, and it was adopted by a number of other poets who felt that he had spoke very elegantly for them. The sensitive spring of my sensibility is pressed against the essence of my being and becoming, the constant broadening of my consciousness and conscience. Thus my life is or has become constant beginning. This, my constant commencement, is the frame of reference which determines my association complexes. My mind's eye looks at anything, be it fat-bellied, fascist, or fishies, and there is movement, the intention of which is to release my intention, and I have written a line, a release of force. There is nothing like art in the oppressive sense of art. There's only movement, force, creative power. The walk of the Sophia Town to Tsotsi, or my Harlem brother on Lenox Avenue, field hollows, the blues, a train riff, Coltrane that is, Marvin Gaye, Ayumbakenga, anguished happiness, creative power, in whatever form it is released, moves like the dancer's muscles. But the impulse is personal. Therefore, the lines I write are about me and how I relate to myself and to the world. Since I am a part of the world, a release of the greater force, these lines are finally about the world. I fanatically believe in the supremacy of the spirit. Any and every child born into the world deserves all the dignity and respect there is, in short, love, which is not a privilege, but a natural right. I passionately hate anything or anybody who violates this. I do not write protest poetry. My poetry is a love poetry. Check out any black ghetto in the world. Listen to the songs and move people to the innovation of all kinds of dances and crazy hollers, and tell me if that is not love. My poetry is that spirit throbbing with the love of millions of black people all over the world. But the impulse is personal. My stance is racial, and no apologies for that. The world is in such a bad state today because of white racism, because of the white world's denial of the supremacy of the spirit, because of the white world's denial of love. I do not write English. The language of a people serves them to satisfy their needs and aspirations. The English give love as a privilege or a means towards some material profit, and I have historical evidence. Mine is an international black language, summoning the power of millions of indignant black people for the final destruction, symbolic or real, of any agency that denies the world love. This is the rumbling of the inevitable fury of millions of black people sick and tired of the role European refugees have made them play for centuries. This is the moving spirit of black masses when they hear the strained laughter of a distant drum, stomping the ear of the world, asserting themselves in the supremacy of the spirit. But after I have written a poem, a release of force, it stands still like the defiant baobab tree. I move on because it is obsolete for me. But somebody after me will catch the riff and move on. I fight like the actual battle. The physical confrontation is going to be a second from now. So will my son, I hope. And this is one of the poems which illustrates this credo. It's called The Elegance of Memory. Distances separate bodies, not people. Ask those who have known sadness or joy. The bone of feeling is pried open by a song. The elegance of color, a familiar smell, this flower, or the approach of an evening. And this is now. I used to wonder, was her grave warm enough? Marika Lady, my grandmother, as big-spirited as she was big-legged, she would talk to me. She would, how could I know her sadness then, or who broke my father's back? But now, the elegance of memory, deeper than the grave, where she went before I could know her sadness, is larger than the distance between my country and I. Things more solid than the rocks with which those sinister thieves tried to break our back. I hear her now, and I wonder, now does she know the strength of the fabric she wove in my heart for us? Her voice, clearer now than then. Boyki, don't ever take any nonsense from them, you hear? There are memories between us, deeper than grief. There are feelings between us much stronger than the cold enemy machine that breaks the back. Sister, there are places between us deeper than the ocean, no distances. Pry your heart open, brother, mine too. Learn to love the clear voice, the music and the memory pried open to the bone of feeling, no distances. Like Langston Hughes, who was a true blues and jazz poet, some of the new poets are obsessed with the idea of unifying their poetry with basic black musical forms. If one is to judge poetry on the basis of meters and music, we must decide which music we're talking about, said California poet Stanley Crouch, who is also one of the fine young critics who's coming on the scene. That is, the high-floating sound from Bach, Brahms, Mozart, so forth, is fine for Yeats, Pound, Williams, and the like. But we black people season our ears on different sound rhythm arrangements. That is, if a song like Charlie Parker's Ornithology is considered flat, then poetry sprung from that sound is also flat. Flat is bebop, which we all know by now, I hope, was and is beautiful. And here's one of Mr. Crouch's poems that illustrates what he's trying to do. I hope I can read it to get the nuances. It's called Too Late Blues. Ain't no ambulances for no niggas tonight. The jitterbug diddybops thought they was off in the boogie, but it was another dance altogether to the devil. So as Bo Dollar, Bo Peep, and the others grinded against their women, they fell perforated under the flames of baby, baby, baby. I should have said, this poem was written shortly after the Watts Rebellion. Horns as tall as cornstalks had sprung from the head of the beast. His tail made a tunnel through his striped pants and flapped through the vent of his frock coat. His fangs came forward, and he French-tongued his dogs before coming down and led rain to the rest of Dark Town. Monkey Jr. was ready when it went down, but couldn't get nobody to go with him. The sun shone across the livid face of white America was when the torture broke, took off, came out of the blocks of gun barrels, running fast. Didn't stop for nobody, swept all the niggers and Watts out of Will Rogers Park, hummed their sirens, and came down too cold on the boulevard, 103rd Street, blowing people away. And they, the woolly-headed would-be lovers, would-be warriors, bit concrete. Under the fast-creeping bullets, forgot I'm sure. Out to kill every nigger they could. And they carried a victim, dripping red up the steps of the police station, asking only for an ambulance, but the beast manning the valiant Watts station said, No ambulances for no niggers tonight. No one went wild. They had been too busy getting high. They could not see the pink face of the oppressor sitting on the bull's eye of the black knight. Therefore, whatever guns the dom and hi-hat did, no good, merely helped pave the way for tombstones. The devil ages were the days now that we were in, never too cool to kill a brother, but always dropping the gun when the beasts with the badges arrived. And they shot little Fats all of 9 times after having made him get down on his knees and raise his arms in prayer. 40 million slabs were laid out. Fashion plate nationalists were too busy making money selling clothes to notice. They died in their bright African colors, Swahili curses dripping from their mouths. Many revolutionaries got theirs in the ass. Another bourgeois bitch, preparing her for the revolution. Many who slipped in college and skated out with degrees were huff-puffing their way up the Mount Everest of the middle class when the tongue rope red up the hunky's ass was cut and they landed on sabers. Ow! But it wasn't bebop. And Monkey Jr. found himself almost alone. But the nigger did get on his job, straight out Mau Mau, Nat Turner madness. The red that passed for blood in the devil's veins laid out everywhere. He caught them, in kitchens grinning at the massacre over the radio. The housewives, the daughters, the babies, all their heads, yeah, set up in their windows like pumpkins, their bodies stuffed in their washing machines, piled in their bathtubs, and he masqueraded. White men stabbed in the belly by the shoeshine boy he pretended to be, or spikes run through their mouths, nailing their heads to the floor by elevator boys with bloody gloves running up the alley. He dismembered babies and shitted on their bodies. Monkey Jr. was a wild madman, a black hurricane carrying knives and dancing through the white cities. He alone and no others was the only one to survive. And the sun, which had grasped its light, reflected from the eyes of black women and its heat from the love of their men, the sun went skinny and fell wheezing into the sea, warming it to a pallid soup of dead fish and melted pearls. The beasts did not adapt to darkness, starved, finding no one else to kill, and Monkey Jr., on his knees, the only man left, prayed. While the new black literature is where it is most dynamic, informed by a spirit of nationalism, some of the best of the current novelists managed to bridge rather effectively the generation of Langston Hughes and that of the exciting young writers who, for the most part, have been published only in the new black journals and a few anthologies. Outstanding among this group are William Melvin Kelly, Kristin Hunter, and Ronald Fair. Mr. Kelly and Ms. Hunter, while increasingly nationalistic in their personal outlook, have not yet moved to the point where their characters do not react directly to the overwhelming presence of whites. Mr. Kelly's latest novel, Dim, is a satirical look at middle-class white America. And Ms. Hunter's latest novel for adults, The Landlord, deals with the adventures of a liberal white man who chooses to involve his life with the lives of some denizens of a black-occupied apartment house. However, Ms. Hunter's newest book is a novel for juveniles called The Soul Brothers and Sister Lou, for which she won the 1968 award of the Council on Interracial Books for Children. This book is important in that it represents Ms. Hunter's concrete break from being just a writer, not a Negro writer. Like so many intellectuals of her age, the middle 30s, Ms. Hunter has come back home. In a special article published in Publishers Weekly in connection with her new book and the award, Ms. Hunter discusses her personal identity crisis. My generation was the last to make an all-out effort to be white, she says. And as the last in line of this thrust, we traveled the farthest and suffered the most when we were eventually, inevitably, brought up short. We went to Ivy League schools. We spoke almost too perfect English, as well as French. We traveled in Europe. We socialized with whites. Some of us even married them. Then came the inevitable day when we realized, individually and collectively, that it had all been to no avail. Ms. Hunter wrote her book for young blacks because she feels that, unlike her generation, the youngest black people have already gone through this crisis and come out whole. In his second novel, Hog Butcher, Ronald Fair's hero is a young black boy who is thrown into the mire of political sordidness in the Chicago ghetto, but who emerges both whole and strong. All of these books have characters who fit the mold of the new image of black manhood the militant black public is demanding. Perhaps the best of the current non-nationalist black novelists is Ernest J. Gaines of San Francisco, author of two excellent novels, Catherine Cormier and Of Love and Dust, and a collection of short stories, Bloodline. The protagonists in Mr. Gaines's two novels are very different kinds of men, but they share a fiber and a strength which, though always present in black men of their backgrounds, have rarely been portrayed in fiction. The one is college-bred, assured, reflective, returned to his native Louisiana to reassess his past in order to determine his future. The other is a hard-bitten rebel, but a man sure of his personal magnetism and of his manhood, and determined to diminish neither. Mr. Gaines's themes are love, endurance, and the tragedy inherent in the human resistance to inevitable change. His style is lucid, his technique quiet and sure. Some of the more talented of the writers spawned by the Black Revolution are women. Outstanding among these are Alice Walker, Jean Wheeler Smith, Carolyn Rogers, and Audre Lee. Miss Lee recently published her first novel, The Clarion People, and the others have novels in progress. All four have published short stories, and two, Miss Rogers and Miss Walker, have published volumes of poetry. Mrs. Smith, a veteran of SNCC, has written movingly of the struggle for manhood among the young SNCC workers under siege in the South, and of the women whose spirits are bent on the altar of that manhood. Miss Rogers, a member of the writers' group concerned with the articulation of a black aesthetic, concentrates on capturing in her stories and short plays the soulful essence of the black experience. The new black writers have decided that their destiny is not at the mercy of white people, white critics in particular, that they live in a world with options. This does not mean that they have ceased to protest the indignities they still experience. Every black person who realizes how sick American white society is, by the logic of this awareness, makes a protest, a positive protest, Cecil Brown, a new critic, says. This is a delicate point which the oversimplification of Richard Wright's social reality, he feels in Native Son, has obscured. Positive protest that creates as it eliminates. It deals with the opposition's ugliness by concentrating on its own beauty. Leroy Jones's prose is positive protest because it is witty and beautiful to black people, which means simply that white people can't understand it. And David Lorenz, another young writer, says, the contemporary black writer understands that as white people lose control over our lives, their last recourse, their final imposition, will perhaps be an attempt to ensure that our deaths are in accordance with their will. A love poem to a man who is being choked is a poem that teaches him how to get the damn hands from around his neck, and moreover, teaches him how to create an order in which he will never be choked again. Drawing from an experience that is far wider than that of the white American, and understandably beset with the ambivalence more painful than artists anywhere have known, the black writer is about his work. There's a great deal of literary excitement in the black communities of America. And out of it will come a fresh and mature literature which can only expand the dimensions of art and consciousness in America. The plays of Leroy Jones, the poems of Sonia Sanchez and Donnell Lee, the novels of Ishmael Reed and Sam Greenlee, and the prose of Julius Lester are strong and viable works which speak directly to the revolutionary black sensibility. And now, of course, the white critics, having failed to destroy the buds of this new literature, are beginning to find a slot in which to isolate it and thus avoid the pain it gives them. In an extraordinary series of essays published recently in the New Republic, critic Richard Gilman all but admitted that Eldridge Cleaver's book, Soul on Ice, had forced him to consider if perhaps black writing is not, after all, beyond his competence to judge. A few years earlier, as drama critic of Newsweek magazine, Mr. Gilman had told a group of black writers that they were incapable of creating mature drama. What he meant, of course, was that black drama did not speak to him with the cadence, substance, and the style by which he measured the work of plays. And of course, what he did not say is that black playwrights had been hampered in what they did because the people who are concerned with putting plays on stage continually say to these playwrights that you have to either write so that what you're saying is acceptable to us, or else we will not accept it. Now, Mr. Gilman is willing to admit that, just possibly, this forceful and disturbing black literature requires a new yardstick. The revolutionary black writers will be the first to agree that the traditional Western criteria is not always relevant to their work. But they will also resist the effort of the Richard Gilmans of this world ever again to establish criteria for them. Thank you. Harold Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller, and good evening, students, faculty of the University of Illinois. This is my first visit into your broad and flat country. I had to remark when I got here that the interior structures and buildings of the university were patterned after the wide spaces outside, because everything is space, 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 largeness, and bigness. But after I got here, I was, I must say, a little taken aback, because what I thought I was going to encounter, I found things at another qualitative level. I've been going around the country and different campuses, and I must say that on this question of black studies, which is my main theme here tonight, I'm struck by the varying levels of commitment and achievement with the different black studies approaches on different campuses. And I'm sometimes thrown off balance on just how to approach this topic on a level that the different campuses have approached it or have reached at any given moment. I want to speak out of my own experience at Michigan, but I think that it's more proper that I speak more directly to your experience here and take everything at its given level and try to develop more insights and more expertise in dealing with the many problems incident to the whole question of black studies. I want to speak here now briefly on the role of the black intellectuals and the new writers that Mr. Fuller has so beautifully described, and their relationship to this whole question of black studies. Because, as with the case of the new black writers out in the urban centers today, black studies also presents us with the possibilities and, in fact, the imperatives of establishing new forms. If the black writers, or the young black writers out there in the urban centers are developing new literary forms and new means of expressions, of expressing their feelings about present-day America, then it is axiomatic then that on the campuses that I would think the Black Studies programs must begin on their own level to complement all of this, and in order to form to bring about the elements here of a new cultural philosophy growing out of the Black experience in America. So I'm going to speak of Black intellectuals and new writers and Black Studies programs, and I speak of Black Studies programs in terms of what I see as the new forms in academic pursuits demanded by this problem of the Black Studies programs. It is my feeling that the cultural stream of the Black experience in the United States is the fundamental key to this whole question of Black Studies. New writing is part of that stream. New poetry is part of that stream. The new aesthetic experience is a part of that stream. However, historically, the stream has a far-reaching background. There's a history behind this stream. And I, for one, would like to see the Black Studies emphasis on this cultural stream serve to relate to what the writers are doing, what the writers are saying, what they are trying to express. Because they are trying to give contemporary expression to the Black experience, when in fact the history of this cultural stream has presented us with a whole lot of material that needs to be reevaluated, that needs to be researched in order to help to create better and more expressive images, which are not only contemporary in their appeal, but also would help to give us a sense of history. I would like to see the young Black writers today develop an historical perspective on their materials in order to deepen and to magnify the images and make them bigger than life, so that their impact on our society would be much more effective aesthetically, critically, culturally, in every other way. This in fact demands a new kind of critique. The young Black writers today are really involved in a new kind of critique, a self-critique, you might call it. And this critique must be amplified by the additional ingredients that we here are going to attempt to dig out of our past and add to the, as one of the new tools that the new young writers can use and develop. I think all writers, for example, need an historical perspective on themselves and on their people and on their traditions. I think the historical perspective is what creates great writers. And I think that a lot of these young writers today are going to be great writers. But it's going to depend on what all segments of the Black movement, particularly the students' movement, does to supplement what these young Black writers are attempting to do. We can no longer be satisfied today with what I choose to call the existentialist kind of response to our situation in America. This kind of response assuredly is what we're going to get from the young writers. But I want to see this develop into something else. I want to see a new generation of writers with an historical perspective on what they are dealing with in terms of the Black cultural ingredients. This means then that in the same way that young Black writers attempt to write poetry which corresponds to the blues and jazz rhythms, in that same way, we need to develop writing which begins to relate to every other aspect of the Black experience outside of the craft of writing. Because Black people in America have been known to be very expressive on all levels of creativity, from music to dance to poetry to theater and so forth. And we need a new critical school of thought which comprises all of these historical and cultural ingredients that have made our people what they are today. And this requires a critical approach to the black background. And without a critical approach to the black background in America and in Africa, in the Western Hemisphere, we are going to be hamstrung intellectually and academically in our approach to the question of black studies. It is true that at this moment, University of Illinois and in other campuses, many black students are having their problems in coming to grips with their own demands about the content and the thrust of black studies. How to formulate programs, how to formulate courses, how to set up structures, how to create content, how to set up research projects. These are the very practical problems facing those most motivated and most involved in the problem of black studies. And I want to relate my experiences and my remarks to those aspects of it. One of the problems here in developing a black studies program, naturally, is a lack of model, a lack of what you might call other standards, because in the traditions of our educational institutions, these standards and models have not been handed down to us. We have to create these things out of our own sense of need, out of our own involvement, out of our own understanding. We have no precedents here for the establishment of black studies programs. And when we raise this issue, a lot of us are not really fully aware at all times of what a profound question this is, what the deep imperatives are, and what kind of responsibilities the black studies programs are going to put on us, those who are involved in the development of such programs. The responsibilities here are these. The development of a new critical attitude toward our past. The development of research methods to dig up the hidden and the obscured facts of our past. The critical ability to dig back into the past and take all of those factors and ingredients and synthesize them and make a construct out of them and relate them to what is happening today. If you talk about the new writing and the new poetry, I want to see in the black studies programs courses, seminars established where students are able to compare the new poetry with the old poetry, to reevaluate the Phyllis Wheatleys and the Langston Hughes and the Paul Laurence Dunbars and all the other great outstanding poets that we have produced. I want to see a black studies program established where we discuss literature and the novel and the drama and so forth, that we are able to compare the new young black writers and what they are doing with what has been done in the past, to create a critical whole out of our experience and relate the present to the past, to get historical perspective on our past in order to make the current expressions of literature and creativity more complete, more expressive, and more related to what we are as a people. In other words, to reflect the cultural stream of the black experience in every aspect of creativity. One has to develop tools in order to do this. One has to know where to look for the leads, to look for the information. One has to know how to set up research teams, research goals, research guides, research projects. I think that the cultural aspects of the black experience, as I said in the beginning, are the key to the political, the historical, the economical, the economic, the sociological, the political, and so forth, the religious. Culture is the aspect of our experience in America which white critical standards have traditionally attempted to downgrade and to obscure. It is our cultural reality which is in effect has been defaced and de-emphasized and distorted. And no people who are in the throes of trying to recapture the meaning of their past can achieve this without a profound reevaluation of their cultural heritage. I maintain that the cultural stream of the black experience is the key to the black studies programs, is the key to the creation of new academic forms, if you will, in the pursuit of the black studies programs. This means, again, a new kind of a critique, because the history of other art forms are necessary in the evaluation of this new evaluation of literature and poetry. Expression. We are great on these levels, but the society under which we have developed has prevented us from developing that kind of critique on what we are culturally. It is because of this that we have been subjected for so many decades to the critical standards of the white writer and the white critic. If we are going to develop what I call any level of cultural autonomy, that is, the self-control over one's own cultural reality, the self-critical domination and autonomy over one's cultural stream, if we're going to achieve this, it means the creation of another kind of a critique. Because, after all, fundamentally, black studies is in itself another kind of a critique. Another critique on ourselves, another critique on what America is and has been and how we have fitted into this American frame. Black studies is another kind of social, critical, and cultural critique, and it must be founded, I believe, in a reevaluation of the cultural stream. New writers and critics must be supplemented by these black studies programs. We will encounter problems here, not only in the formulation and the creation of course material. We're going to encounter problems in the bringing together of the proper kind of academic personnel who have the insight and the motivation and the perception to bring to black studies this kind of critical stature that black studies requires. This is the problem facing you on this campus and other students on other campuses. And as I said at the outset, we have all arrived at this point at different varying levels of attainment and achievement in the creation of black studies programs. The problem of content is a big hang-up, is the big block in the minds of many students. But what I want to elaborate here is to point up the great wealth of material, the great wealth of experience that lies in the urban centers, in black life, where one through which one can create the connections, create the organic connections between what is happening on the campuses and what is part of the reality of the black experience. Because if the black studies programs are not that related to what is happening outside the campus confines, in the urban centers, in the regions where black people live, then the black studies programs are not fulfilling the requirements of a real and genuine Black Studies program. What I'm saying here is that in approaching it, we have to break, like the Black writers have broken, with the Western standards of critical evaluation. We must break with those same standards in terms of the academic achievement or academic evaluation of what is intellectually sound and what is critically relevant. The new Black writers, from their point of view, have the same problem that the students have from their point of view. There is a relation here in the imperatives and the necessities, and that all of these things are a part of one and the same thing. They are related. And the better that we relate all of these efforts, the more successful in the long run will all of these creative and academic efforts be. The more successful will they become as relevant academic pursuits relevant to the needs of Black people beyond the confines of the university. I don't want to lecture you too long because I prefer exchange. I prefer give and take. I prefer questions and answers. I prefer problems being voiced by people who are having difficulties in dealing with this issue. The issues are so complicated and they're so complex that it requires, I say, one constant, never-ending seminar around these problems. Because the Black experience is so many-sided, we have the problem here of relating a whole raft of Black experience historically that have not been considered by standard history. We have the problem here of relating all of this to the contemporary scene. We have the problem here of looking very objectively, if we can, into our background and avoiding a sense of alienation from anything that has ever happened to us since we arrived on these shores, whether from a religious point of view or a sociological point of view or a racial point of view or political point of view or economic point of view or whatever, that everything in our existence is a valid experience. There's nothing to be ashamed of. There's nothing in slavery to be ashamed of when you begin to examine it historically, when you begin to examine it intellectually and critically. In fact, this attitude, this approach toward these aspects of our experiences are what is going to raise them to a new level of academic achievement, a new level of academic value. Because we live in a society, in this American society, a society which, for many reasons, is an anti-historical society, a society which leads people to think that nothing is important unless it is happening today or is going to happen tomorrow. A point of view which tends to prevent people from linking their current situation with trends of the past. For this reason, I want to say to the Black students today in the University of Illinois who are wrestling with this problem, try to keep an open mind if you can. Try to understand that these things cannot be achieved in a day. It's going to take years, I would say, to develop the kind of Black Studies program you want to see brought here immediately. Because the Black Studies program is going to have to be the means by which you are going to develop the kind of personnel tomorrow or next year that you want to be here available to you today. Unfortunately, these kind of resources just do not exist in that degree that we can reach out and willy-nilly bring in all kinds of resources out there waiting at our beck and call. This is not the way things have developed in our experience. We are a victim of a certain kind of educational conditioning, which has left us bereft of the resources that we need at this moment to carry on this kind of work. So it really comes down to a question of a point of view that we're going to bring to the Black Studies program. We must see that that only through the way in which we develop these programs will they succeed in doing away with the deficiencies that we are aware of now. The Black Studies programs must be that agency through which new scholars are developed from the younger student generation to make up for the glaring lack of scholarship today along these lines. That only will that the students themselves must be motivated or be motivated by the Black Studies program to bring to the Black Studies program that kind of content, that kind of concern which they want to see inculcated at this moment. It is all a question of time, it's all a question of motivation, it's all a question of application, it's all a question of planning, it's all a question of how we motivate ourselves to respond and to deal with the necessities. These are the answers to the Black Studies programs. There are no formulas here for this. There are no set methods for achieving what we want to achieve because we have no precedents for this. So allow me to end this short talk by saying that the way that the new young writers are going about their functions should serve as a guide and a key to how we in the academic world should begin to deal with the question of Black Studies, because Black Studies are in themselves new forms of academic pursuit, and that in order to make them relevant, we must find new forms in which to put the content of our history and the cultural stream of our Black experience. Thank you.